From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Kurt Bester was destined to be a performer. Born to a musical family, he studied music composition in college and found early success scoring films and composing TV themes and commercial jingles. But as a young musician, Bester wanted to find a niche, so he looked around and found Christmas. When he recorded his first Christmas CD in 1988, skeptics told him the season was too short to build a career on. But doubt faded when he performed to a sellout crowd and a holiday tradition was born. Tonight, he launches his 24th annual A Kurt Bester Christmas Concert at Abravanel Hall. And today on the program, he joins us in studio to talk about improvisation, the lure of the stage, and his new Grammy nomination. Plus, Salt Lake Art Center gets a new name and a new image. All that and your calls after the news. From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Kurt Bester was destined to be a performer. Born to a musical family, he studied music composition in college and found early success scoring films and composing TV themes and commercial jingles. But as a young musician, Bester wanted to find a niche. So he looked around, and he found Christmas. When he recorded his first Christmas CD in 1988, skeptics told him the season was too short to build a career on, but doubt faded when he performed to a sellout crowd and a holiday tradition was born. Tonight, he launches his 24th annual A Kurt Bester Christmas Concert at Abravanel Hall. And today on the program, he joins us in studio to talk about improvisation, the lure of the stage, and his new Grammy nomination. Plus, Salt Lake Art Center gets a new name and a new image. All that in your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. For many, Kurt Bester and Christmas are synonymous, with his holiday season concert selling out 24 years running. But in addition to being an undeniably talented performer with warm and engaging stage presence, he's also a composer, songwriter, and now a Grammy-nominated producer and arranger. Tonight, Bester begins his annual holiday concerts at Abravanel Hall, and today he joins me in studio. And Kurt Bester, thanks so much for your time and for being here on the day of your concert.
This is a first, man. I have never done an interview on the day of the show, so I must be prepared or stupid.
Kurt Bester, of course, is an Emmy award-winning composer and producer with 40 feature-length films, 16 CDs, numerous television themes, and a mix of live shows under his belt. In addition to his popular Christmas concerts, he's conducted and performed with numerous groups, including Utah Symphony, the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and Choir, the Estonian National Orchestra and others. And last week, he received his first Grammy nomination. And A Kurt Bester Christmas with special guest Melissa Manchester opens tonight at 7:30 at Abravanel Hall. Other performances are throughout the weekend. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about contemporary art, and it is getting a higher profile here in Utah. But first, Kurt Bester. If A Kurt Bester Christmas is a holiday tradition for you, tell us why. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Kurt Bester, before we get into your extensive musical portfolio, I understand you staged your first flash mob on Black Friday.
I did.
As a seasoned performer, I'm really curious how this kind of impromptu public performance differs from the orchestrated stage performances that you're used to.
Well, to be honest, flash mobs, especially musical ones, if they're going to be successful, are almost more planned out than planned out concerts, because you've got to be very organized and get all your people to know their little choreography and all the stuff they're going to do in that mall. This happened to be in a mall, so that it really comes off. Now, I wasn't able to be there because I was performing at the Gallivan Center for the Lights On ceremony, but I did see the video, and it was fun. They did a great job. I did an arrangement of Ding Dong Merrily on High. I got asked by Craig Jessup, the former conductor of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, called me up. He knows that I do strange things, and I like musical Rubik's Cubes. So he said, look, we want to do this flash mob. he said, what song would you suggest? And I thought, Ding Dong Merrily House, like that. And we could use bells. So people could bring bells in their purses. And I said, we could have fiddles, we could have drums, things that people can kind of pull out and play along with. So the piece itself actually is an amalgam of quite a few different styles. And it's got a classical vibe to it, kind of a shuffle Cape Breton style fiddle thing. And anyway, it turned out it was fun. And so I was always up for a challenge. When somebody calls me and says, you know, we want to try this and do this, it's stimulating for me. You know, yes, I made a little money on the deal, but it was more than that. It was a chance to do something unique. So there you go. And you can check it out online if you want.
And we'll put a link on our website, kcpw.org. Kurt Bester, you grew up in Provo, and your fans will be familiar with the story that you tell about your mother and how she encouraged you to practice as a child, asking you to play a sunrise instead of just those scales. Why do you think that invoking imagery really motivated you in a way that, you know, maybe sitting down and, you know, you got to do your half an hour of practicing today or else?
Well, you know, I did have to do my half hour or else, but for me, and my mom saw this, my mother's also very creative, a former school teacher in Utah County. She could see that the scales, the craft of music wasn't really turning me on, but that the art of music was. And she wanted to really quickly show me the art of music so that I could go through the craft, because you have to know how to play in order to portray your art. And so I think that's really what my mom had in mind. And I always have been one who can't just play notes. I have to play feelings or play imagery. A lot of people sometimes say that my music sounds like a film score looking for a film. And I guess that's true, because I can't just play notes. I have to play something that comes from within. And my mom recognized that. And that's why she told me to do that. And we're thinking about writing a book, actually, my mom. She's 81, very vital years, years old. She goes to the gym every day, Gold's Gym. So she's very, very active. We're going to write a book about creativity and how to teach your kids to be creative. Anyway, that's where that story comes from.
Mm. Your musical career began very young. You started writing jingles for commercials, even for Muzak.
Yes, I did. I apologize to everybody, and especially to the Beatles, because I did Norwegian Wood in a Muzak style. So next time you go into Safeway or ride an elevator, I apologize.
You also won an Emmy for your composition for the 1988 Olympics, and now you've got this Grammy nomination, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. But where does it come from? You know, for those of us who don't have this gift, can you kind of walk us through what the composition process is like, what it feels like?
You know, that is a really great question, and one that sometimes I ask myself. I mean, I try to explain it to people. It's not mystical and magical, but there is a part of it that is. And typically, I get asked to do a deadline. Somebody's saying, here's a movie, score it. We need a commissioned piece. Here's a flash mob. Do it. And so I have a task in front of me. And that's easy enough to figure out. Then I kind of figure out what the palette's going to be, what the orchestration's going to be. And that's pretty easy to figure out. But then to kind of connect to something inside, it's almost like plasma. I think about it. I think about the feeling I want to portray. And I can't hear it in my head. A lot of people think that's what happens to composers, that we go around with this symphony in our head at all time. It's for me, it's more of just kind of I can taste it. It's starting to take shape. It's a plasma that's starting to take shape of a song. And then when I actually sit down to write it down, in the old days it was on paper with a pencil. Now I use computers, but it's almost kind of already written in my, I can feel it, I can taste it, and I just start putting shape to it and carving away everything that doesn't look like a musical elephant. So that's the process. I don't know if that answered the question, but then I get to the point where I go through the craft of it, the orchestration, the writing.
Well, that
down.
To me seems like the really complicated part, because a lot of people, you know, you get a little catchy melody
right,
in your head
right.
and it won't go away, and you think, oh, this is the beginning of a song, but putting it together and having a 30-piece orchestra and, you know, all the different moving parts, that to me seems like the real craft.
It is the craft. It's funny that I think the harder part for me is actually just kind of getting something creative popping out of my brain, the writing it down, the figuring out how to paint it. If you look at composition, the melody and the harmony is, to me, is kind of like India ink. The watercolor and the colors that I put on, that's kind of orchestration. And I enjoy, it's almost like two different processes. So it's something I really enjoy doing. I like the tedious process of it, but there's also a flashpoint where it just kind of comes fast. And I've written some songs. That's why I never tell people how long it takes me to do it, because they go, well, how come I'm paying you this much money if it only took you that long? Sometimes it takes you a long time, but sometimes it just like comes out like a volcano, and you almost feel like you're floating when you, it's a floaty kind of experience. I think artists and poets and writers sometimes get in that same zone. Hours go by and you've written this thing and you haven't felt like eating or anything. You're just like floating. It's that's the mystical part.
Kurt Bester. He's an Emmy Award-winning composer, a performer. His Kurt Bester Christmas with special guest Melissa Manchester opens tonight at Abravanel Hall. If you've got questions, feel free to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Of course, you're so well known for your Christmas performances. You've been performing and arranging Christmas songs for a couple dozen decades now. What do you think it is about Christmas songs that really engages people in a way that other songs don't? And how do you keep it fresh?
That there's a couple of questions in there that I ask myself. How do I keep it fresh? Well, first of all, the music from Christmas comes with a lot of memories for everybody, and it's not always just Christians. I mean, it's just anybody in America is going to see a Christmas tree, pretty, you know, which is a pagan thing anyway. But there's the smells of Christmas, there's the foods, there's the memories. Those things I can tie into. So if I write a little Christmas song, say I take the tune "Ding Dong Maryland High," I can write it to kind of tie into that kids opening presents. I can take "What Child Is This" and do something incredibly sacred sounding. There's lots of emotions that come prepackaged with Christmas, and they're typically happy memories. And so in that regard, it's kind of fun to tie into. I'm going to be really honest about something. I started doing Christmas music because nobody knew who I was. And my record company at the time said, look, you want to do an album, but nobody knows your name. And I said, well, what if I do an album of instrumental Christmas music? Now, there was only Mannheim Steamroller at that time that did that. This is back in 87. Mm-hmm. And I just said, I love Christmas music. People know the songs. They may not know my name, but maybe I can get them interested in me with something that they like. So that, to be honest, I'm going to be really honest. That sounds terrible. Sounds like I'm some big, you know.
All got to make a living, right?
Well, you know, the nice thing about it is people really resonated with the music. I don't think it was a bad album. I'm proud of it to this day. And if it was a good thing for them and a good thing for me, then we all win. So, and then 24 years later, I'm kind of stuck in the Christmas mode, but it's a happy place to be.
That is a happy place to be. We cannot go any further without playing something. I want to play a clip from your arrangement of "O Holy Night." Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think of you as a very talented musician, a composer, a pianist. Mm-hmm. And yet in this recording, you're not playing the piano.
Maybe I'm playing flugelhorn, actually.
Flugelhorn. So what exactly is a flugelhorn?
It's kind of a trumpet on steroids. It's if you remember Chuck Mangione, and you're probably a little too young, but he was a famous flugelhorn player. It's played like a trumpet, but it has a more conical, rounded sound. And I'm playing in this recording with members of the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, so I recorded this over in Europe.
Okay, let's take a listen. This is Kurt Bester, "O Holy Night." Maybe. Let's see. Let's try that again. Technical difficulties. Live radio. Here we go. Kurt Bester on flugelhorn with the Czech Philharmonic. It must be such a thrill to be able to be in that moment.
You know,
when your creation comes to life.
Well, and that's really astute of you. That to me is the drug. That is the thing that keeps me going through the late nights and the low pay and everything else that comes with being a musician these days. When you listen to something that was in your brain, that was part of you, and then you stand in front of an orchestra and you play, and it comes back at you, played by 80 musicians, it's almost out of otherworldly to me. It's like I'm hearing my brain played by all these people. And it just wraps around me and feels so good. This song we will play at the concert the next few days, and it just never, I never tire of it because it's part of me, and I love playing flugelhorn too. So it's gonna be nice.
It's a beautiful arrangement. Not all of your work is traditional symphonic stuff. You also have a very playful side. And before we head into a break, I want to play another clip from your vast collection of Christmas music. Sort of this funky tongue-in-cheek piece. it's called Deck the Halls in Blues. Do you want to set it up for me?
Well,
we play?
Deck the Halls has been arranged many, has had many different translations. This, the song itself, Deck the Halls, we know is fa la la la, that one. But it also has a New Year's Eve version that was written back in the 1800s. It's all about drinking. And I don't know if we can play this here in Salt Lake City, but no, we can't. Anyway, it's a little bit more about the party side. So I thought, how much, well, you know, blues, party, New Year's, here we go.
There we go. Deck the Halls in Blues by Kurt Bester. '70s roots are coming out, Kurt Bester.
Yeah, get off the table there. Stop dancing.
We're speaking with Kurt Bester, Emmy Award-winning composer and performer. His recent Grammy nomination, A Kurt Bester Christmas with special guest Melissa Manchester, opens tonight at 7:30 at Abravanel Hall. More information about that and a video of his flash mob on our website, kcpw.org. If you've got questions or comments for Kurt, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pearson. This is City Views. We're talking with the multi-talented, multi-dimensional Kurt Bester. And if you've got questions or comments, feel free to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. As I mentioned earlier, last week you got your first Grammy nomination. Congratulations,
yeah,
by the way.
Thank you.
It's for your work with violinist Jenny Oakes Baker. Whose idea was it to offer this fresh take on Disney, on Disney tunes?
Well, to be honest, Jenny and I, we go way back. We've done about 6 or 7 albums together. And when she said, here's the next album I want to do, the one we did before was called Silver Screen, and we did songs from movies. And I love doing that because I'm a movie guy. But then she said, the next album I want to do, Kurt, is a Disney album. There was a long pause, and I was not excited. I mean, it's one thing to do Christmas music, but because it's timeless, even though it's used a lot. But to do Disney, you're just jumping right into pop culture at its most maudlin, and yet when
it's
I
very sweet.
It's sweet by nature. So my job was to have, especially with Jenny, who's a remarkable violinist. I mean, she truly is just one of the greats. my job was to try to say something artistic with it. And that's the problem is how do you get people to open the CD case? You know, it's a Disney album. Well, thankfully, somebody did at the Grammy organization, and they deemed it worthy of a nomination. So I enjoyed the album. And after all was said and done, even though I had held my nose getting into it, I'm probably more proud of this album than just about anything I've done, because the task was so large, and I feel good about it.
You arranged all of the numbers that you produced the album.
Yeah, Jenny gave me a list of a bunch of her favorite songs. I had a few of mine, and then I just started arranging. And she trusts me, which I really appreciate. And I would just send her piano copies of the songs back to her home in D.C., and she would just, almost without any kind of changes, she'd just say, great, you know, this is great. And then I'd orchestrate. We finally got the whole thing together. We've got an orchestra here in Salt Lake City and recorded the orchestra with Jenny. And we, you know, I produced it, so that means I sit behind the board and say, do it again, Jenny, do it again, do it again. It's out of tune. And she's a perfectionist. That woman is amazing, because she just drives herself. But anyway, we'll find out in February how we did in the pop instrumental category.
Congratulations. Many of your collaborators, like Jenny Oakes-Baker, Sam Carden, they're best known as Mormon artists.
Uh-huh.
You yourself served a mission for the LDS Church, and yet I read in a Deseret News profile some years ago that you've got sort of a complicated relationship with the church. You've been divorced a couple of times. How do you address the questions of your Mormonness and faith, which comes up in this community?
No, absolutely it does. And I appreciate the question. I get asked all the time. And I've taken kind of an interesting approach to it. In Utah, when you answer the question, are you Mormon or are you not Mormon? Are you active? Are you inactive? Those monikers that you get labeled with, they carry with it a lot. It's like shorthand. People then decide, oh, I like you or I don't like you. Oh, you must be a drinker or not drinker. You must be this or that. You're a liberal. And that's why I don't like, I'll answer the question, but I don't like what it means, especially in our community. People just make instantaneous judgments about who you are based on monikers. And so, you know, typically I'm not an active Mormon, and I have no angry feelings or anything. I'm lapsed. I don't know, whatever you want to call me. I am where I am. I believe what I believe, or I believe what I don't know. I don't know. I'm kind of in a little journey, like we all are. I just kind of had to be who I was. But the minute that I start talking about religion, when that article came out, and it's been a decade ago.
It has been a while.
I teased I think it was Doug Robinson for the Deseret News. He won an award for the thing. And I said, well, was it for best fictional article? Anyway, no, it had a lot of interesting deductions in it. And I'm, you know, it came out. But I had a lot of people that said, oh, well, you're having problems with your religion or your beliefs. I said, I'm not having a problem with the religion. I'm just not organized. And I said, so just let me be on my journey and we'll see where I end up. But immediately there were people who said, oh, I'll never come to your Christmas concert again. I'll never buy your CDs. I mean, honestly, there were, you could go and look in the archives. The Deseret News had letters to the editor saying, you know, oh, I've supported you all these years and now I... That's what I'm talking about. When you start talking about religion in this community, you know, it's like choosing sides, and it's polarized. It's not helpful. It's not unifying. And if anything, especially this time of year, I'm not about polarization. I don't care if you're Mormon or not Mormon, active, inactive, Republican or whatever. Just come to the show if you want, and we'll have a wonderful time. It's all about peace on earth, goodwill to men, no matter what moniker you wear.
Mm. Kurt Bester, Emmy Award-winning composer and performer. His Christmas concert season is entering its 24th year, and it opens tonight at Abravanel Hall. You noted that there may be some errors in the Deseret News piece, fictionalized, as you say it.
I have been married a few times, yes. That part's right. I've lived big love one wife at a time, so yeah, that's right.
It did also, in addition to your faith, it addressed music almost as an obsession to you, a first love. But it certainly, just based on your work, it's not your only love. You've been an outspoken proponent of a new performing arts center here in Salt Lake City. You were a national delegate for President Obama in 2008. I guess the question is, do you have political ambitions of your own?
I've been asked to run for office, believe it or not, and I've thought about it, to be honest, because I very much love the whole sociological, communal approach to making change. And I love that. That's why I love being involved in politics. But the political process is something that almost goes counter to my musicianship. So maybe at this point I will be politically active. I'll stand up and be counted, especially when it comes to things like Pink Dot that I'm an ambassador for and some things that I feel are needed in our community. But I probably won't run for office at this point because, first of all, I have a lot of music to do. I have a lot of things to say. And so if I can be visible with my notoriety in this community and help things, I will. But running for office at this point doesn't look promising in the next couple of years.
Knowing that politics is one of your interests, I want to play a clip from another song of yours called Prayer of the Children. And is it politicized? Before we play this, is it an anthem of sorts? Because it's become so popular.
Right. This song, people take ownership of. I've had people say, oh, you're singing about this religion, or oh, you're singing about anti-this or pro that. The song isn't that complicated. The song is simply about a childhood love of peace. And I think that's something to emulate as adults. I always say we should grow up and act more like children, because children don't care who wins the wars. They don't care who wins the elections. They don't care about money. They don't care about taxes. They don't care about the economy. They just want a beautiful place to live with their mom and dad, a warm bed, food, and all those simple things, which really are the essence of life. And that's what the song is about. So anybody that tries to dogmatize it or take ownership of it in some other way, that's their business, I guess. But that's not why it was written.
Hmm. Let's hear Prayer of the Children, recorded by Kurt Bester in 1999.
Can you hear the prayer of the children on bended knee in the shadow of an unknown empty eyes with no more tears to cry, turning heavenward toward the light. Cry, Jesus, help me to see the morning light of one more day. But if I should die before soul today, can you feel the heart of the children aching for home, for something of their very own, reaching hands with nothing to hold on to but hope for a better day, a better day. Cry, Jesus, help me.
Kurt Bester, it's a beautiful song, and a song that has been performed thousands of times around the world, and you were just telling me about a memorable performance you had of this particular piece.
I had a chance to perform at the World Summit back in New York, and they hold this every few years, and luminaries from around the world come in, and I had a chance to sing this song, probably the most important song to me personally, for people that could actually do something with it. I was looking at, as I was performing it, Mikhail Gorbachev, Madeleine Albright, Fidel Castro was in the audience, and Jane Goodall. I am sure there were others, but those are the ones that kind of pop out of my mind. And as I'm singing this song, which is about peace and about children, it really was, for me, a wonderful synergy of creative energy in, and I hope that the message got through to them. I never heard from them, and I was ushered away. I couldn't go talk to them, but it was a wonderful experience. And then when people send me emails saying we just sang this song at Ground Zero, or we sang this, it was in a Columbine, the year after Columbine, it was sung on an album to raise money for the Columbine victims, and that's exactly what you would hope that your music would do. I never planned on even releasing this song. It was just kind of my own frustrations about war and things that I kind of not a big fan of. But for the song to take off like that is like a child that has gone off and made a good life for themselves. So I'm proud of it in that regard.
Hmm. Our time is running short, sadly. Your concerts are sellouts. You've got a Grammy nomination under your belt. I also understand that you're reaching out into new media. Talk about the role that technology is playing in your composition now, and why you've decided to embrace it in such a large extent in your work.
Well, you know, music is music is always music, but the delivery system of music, thanks to Sean Fanning in the day of P2P technology and downloading, I didn't castigate that when it happened. I celebrated digital downloading. Now, the business model is not really great, but we'll figure that out. But I also love the new iPod. All my music now is I read on stage on an iPad, and I turn a page with a Bluetooth foot pedal. So I happen to think that some
you
of the great...
You got your iPad right here.
I do have it right here. It doesn't make for good radio, but yeah, this is where I have all my music, and I just turn the page. So any people that come to the concert... By the way, it's not totally sold out, so you can actually get tickets, but you'll see me use technology. That song that we just heard, Prayer of the Children, I'll sing tonight. It's a tradition. And I'll do it live with a machine that splits my voice into parts. So it kind of makes me sound like that groovy kind of Gregorian chant that let you just heard. Mm-hmm. But that's all done live. And that's technology that enhances art. And some of the other people that you're going to talk to today as you talk about art, you know, some of the new artists around the world are doing the very same thing. There's an artist I read that does all his art now on the iPad, and he projects it to screens that are in galleries, like instantaneously from where he is in England to screens in a gallery. And it's still art. It's just a different, and thanks to technology, new things can be discovered. So I'm a big fan of it. I don't like the fact that it costs me lots of money every time I go down to the Mac store, but you know, I'll overcome that, especially if you come tonight.
Is the Kurt Bester app on its way?
It is. Actually, I am working on an app right now. I can't tell you too much, but it is a new way of appreciating music, not just for Kurt Bester's music, my music, but I'm working with the Doobie Brothers on some. It's an old group that you're probably, again, too young to remember. But I'm working with a few artists on this new delivery, a way for people to monetize but appreciate music. And maybe when I get the app done, we can talk about that sometimes, because it's really fascinating. It's a wonderful, wonderful time to live as an artist, because we can get our music out there in a flash. And we can create it using computers. I think it's a great time. The music's still the same. The art's still the same. It's just a lot easier to get it down and get it out.
Hmm. Kurt Bester, Emmy Award-winning composer, performer. His Kurt Bester Christmas with special guest Melissa Manchester opens tonight at 7:30 at Abravanel Hall. The other performances are throughout the weekend. You can find more information on our website, kcpw.org. Kurt Bester, thanks so much for your time.
It is my pleasure. And everybody, support this great station, would you? I'm going to put that plug in, because this is a jewel in our community. So thank you, Jennifer, for what you do, and thanks to KCPW.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. I want to lead out with your song, I Saw Three Ships. Just very quickly, can you set it up for us as we go?
It's a song that people know and love, done in a way they probably never heard in 7/8 time.
7/8 time. Okay, get your metronomes out. This is Kurt Bester, I Saw Three Ships.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Salt Lake Arts Center has long been devoted to showcasing contemporary art, and that commitment is now reflected in its name. Joining me now to talk about Utah's contemporary art scene and the new name is Adam Price, Executive Director of the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And Adam, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for coming.
Good morning, Jennifer. Thank you for having me.
What do you think about the new UMOCA? If you've got questions or comments about contemporary art and the art scene here in Utah, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Adam, let's start with the most obvious question. Why? Why the name change from Salt Lake Arts Center to Utah Museum of Contemporary Art?
You know, I think the name change really grew out of a conversation that I've been trying to have with the community over the last year and a half. And what I was finding was people were still feeling uncertain about what the Art Center as an institution was offering. And so as we talked it through staff and trustees and with members of the community, we realized that a name like Utah Museum of Contemporary Art would just provide much more clarity, that people understand that a museum is an exhibition venue that the public is intended to enter and to see what's inside, and that contemporary art would help to identify the kinds of art we were showing more clearly.
What was the confusion with Salt Lake Art Center? That seems to be pretty straightforward.
You know, I think art centers, as they manifest themselves institutionally, run a range from institutions that are indistinguishable from museums. Like you think of like the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, but there are also a lot of art centers that are primarily community institutions that do hands-on art making and education for children. And I think people just weren't clear where we fell along that spectrum. And we've really become an exhibition venue more and more over the years. And so I think this is really just a matter of the name catching up with the reality of the institution.
Hmm. Will the name change the way you approach exhibits in any way? Is it identity forming as well? Or is it kind of, like you said, doing what you've already been doing?
I hope that it really reflects what we're already doing. And if it has an identity-forming dimension to it, my hope is that it really sort of locks us into a commitment to consistently and always doing the highest quality exhibitions possible. Other than that, I think it really is about adopting a name that really shows the public what we're already about.
What will set UMOCA apart from other museums in the area? Of course, we've got the BYU Museum of Art. We've got the Utah Museum of Fine Art. What is going to set UMOCA apart?
You know, I think there are two things I would identify. One is that we consistently do contemporary art all year round. We do about 20 exhibitions a year. We're thrilled to have the UMFA has an outstanding contemporary art program, as does BYU. They've both got terrific contemporary curators, but they both have much broader mandates, and so they can only do contemporary programming some of the time. The Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, obviously, as you can tell by our name, will be doing it all of the time. The other piece that I think is important is our location in downtown Salt Lake City, and I think having a contemporary art museum that's right in the heart of our urban core plays a distinct role that's different from other institutions as well.
And yet you change from Salt Lake Art Center to Utah Museum of Contemporary Art.
Yes. We're serving a much broader community. We've been doing exhibitions and programming, particularly the programming that we've been doing outside the four walls of our building, that's been getting people involved all the way from Provo to Ogden. And our educational programs serve that range also. So I think Salt Lake was unnecessarily limiting in terms of the overall community we serve, though obviously our main headquarters is in downtown Salt Lake City.
Adam Price, Executive Director of the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, UMOCA. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Define for us exactly what contemporary art is. Is it a distinct genre as modern art or postmodernism is? Or is it simply a description of art that's being produced right at this moment?
You know, I think if you put 100 art historians in a room and ask that question, you'll get 101 answers. But contemporary art clearly is a recognized genre within the field of art. The modernist period is typically regarded to have ended in the late 1960s and the contemporary period to have begun then. So I think there are certain philosophical and material concerns that unify the field of contemporary art and make it distinct from earlier periods in art history. But it's also true that if you ask some people, they'll say it's simply art that's being created today. I think when we use the name, we mean it in the former sense.
Okay. What are some of the emerging trends that you're seeing in the contemporary art world today and contemporary artists here in Utah?
You know, I think if you were to come by the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art right now, what might surprise you is the incredible diversity of media that are being used. And this really makes sense if you think about it. Artists have always used whatever materials were available in order to express the ideas in their head. And what we've really been trying to do at UMOCA is to push the envelope in terms of what is considered art beyond painting and sculpture, which are the the mainstays of traditional visual artistic expression. And we've got right now video, sound installation, site-specific installations, performance. So it's really just a matter of artists taking advantage of all of the tools that are available to them, all of the physical properties that are available to them to create their work.
Do you find that technology really is becoming as important of a tool in expression as the paintbrush?
I think it is, yeah. Again, it's one of the really exciting movements that I think you can see in contemporary art right now is a slow undoing of the idea of the artist as the sole author of their work, sort of the heroic genius creates their piece. And what you see now is a lot more democratic in its impulses, that it's crowdsourced or that it involves multiple authors in creating a single piece. Even one that we've got right now, a piece by Kim Schoenstatt called Paint by Numbers. She started it, but she's invited the public over 8 weeks to make physical interventions in the work, and then she will come back out at the end of the eight-week period and finish it. But anyone who wants to come down can take a piece of chalk and literally draw on Kim's painting, and we will fill in the shapes that they create with the colors that they've indicated, the staff literally painting by numbers once a week to keep up with the public's participation.
And she's also got a sound element to that exhibit.
She does. There's a piece called Sound Draw, and it's literally a drawing that she made, and all you see is the outline of the shape of the paper. After she was done making the drawing, she destroyed the physical object itself, but there's a sound recording of the process that's left. And her hope is that people might begin to imagine in their own heads what the drawing looks like based on the sounds that they hear.
For hundreds of years, people have gone to a gallery and they've looked at a painting and they've contemplated and there have been benches, and it's been quite a kind of a quiet place of meditation or whatever. I sense that your museum is not quite like that.
You know, we're hoping to make it a really sort of a dynamic and welcoming place. You know, we're doing, in addition to really great exhibitions, and we've got some incredible artists there now. But every cultural institution in the entire country is sort of looking at how do we maintain our relevance and a sense of excitement in an age when, you know, almost anything can be seen on the internet. You know, why is it that people would come down to a museum to see some of those same works? And so partly it's about providing a visitor experience that in its entirety feels very exciting to people. And that's one of the directions we're moving in.
Is the public, I mean, a public that is trained to go and look at a single painting, do they need some training on how to appreciate contemporary art and expectations when you get there?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that question because we're starting a new art appreciation program in January called Art Fitness Training. And it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. You know, the trainers will show up in their sweat clothes and sweatbands as a way of suggesting that there can be some humor in the artistic experience and people can let their guard down. But really the premise of Art Fitness Training is that American museums have done a disservice to the public by essentially debilitating them, making them so accustomed to learning about works of art through reading the didactic labels or taking curator-led tours, that what happens when they're left alone with a work of art is they sort of shrug their shoulders and walk away and say, I don't get this. I can't do this by myself. Mm. And Art Fitness Training is really about the idea that at least one way to understand a work of art is that what's important about it is not what's esoteric, what's hidden, what's in the mind of the artist or what's in the mind of the curator, but that it's a physical object. And that one way to approach it is, I can have a direct, rich experience of this object without any other understanding of the art historical context or any other input except for the cultural birthright that I have as a human being. And I'm capable of generating my own meaning from a careful examination of this work.
So it is what it is. It is what I think it is.
Yeah, I think that's a place to start. I mean, obviously, if you enjoy a piece of work, we hope after Art Fitness training, you'll take the time to learn more about the art historical context or what the artist was thinking or what the curator was thinking. But yes, I mean, there is, it's a language and you're a participant in that language. And you can engage with the work and it will suggest all sorts of things to you based on the experiences that you bring to the work of art.
Adam Price, Executive Director of the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, formerly known as the Salt Lake Art Center. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So are contemporary art collectors out there? Because some of these, the pieces that I have seen, cannot be shown in a home. I don't have a big screen with a projector or a place that, you know, I can experience a sound portrait 24/7.
Yeah. There certainly are collectors of contemporary art, but you're right in identifying the problems of contemporary art objects, that they often are, that they change over time, that they're not meant to be permanent. And so, in fact, what you see that the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art is a non-collecting contemporary art museum. Many museums of contemporary art are now non-collecting precisely because the objects don't last. And that's really, in the world of contemporary art, the concept, the idea of the artist has assumed increasing importance, and the material residue, the object, has actually decreased in importance in that same time period, I think. So you do see this very sort of knotty relationship between the art and the physical manifestation of it in the contemporary field.
Hmm. 2011 really seems to be the year of the museum here in Utah. We've got this new Natural History Museum of Utah that just opened. Earlier this year, the Leonardo opened here on Library Square. You've got a new identity. What is going on here from your vantage point as someone who's very invested in the local art scene?
You know, I think it's really a story of a community coming of age. And I see that in all sorts of ways. You know, I'm not native. I moved here in 1996, and the city has transformed so dramatically in that period of time. And not just
in what ways?
I mean, restaurants, right? I mean, there's amazing new restaurants here now. There's more street life. There's tracks. There's a main library, which is an incredible civic building. I mean, almost everywhere you look, there's sort of the sense of urban life just bubbling up out of the surface. And I think on the cultural side, you're seeing that as well. So it's really, for me, it really is a sort of a story about a community coming of age. And I think the concerns of the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art are how to take the city that's really coming into its own and connect us with this completely global dialogue in and among artists who are working all over the world, bringing their voices in, bringing our voices out, and keeping us connected with the human race all around us.
The new UMOCA, you've got a role in EVE, the end of year celebration that's happening in Salt Lake City. Just briefly, tell us what part of EVE the UMOCA will take. What's happening at UMOCA during the EVE celebration?
So obviously we'll be open with our five galleries of exhibitions all through EVE, as we always are. But we'll be adding in a number of performative pieces as well that people can come and enjoy just for those 3 days, including artist-designed karaoke videos, so you can come and sing your hearts out to videos made by local artists. We'll have a free hugs project for people who are feeling a little bit of New Year's melancholy.
Aww.
And then we'll also be doing hands-on art making for both children and adults.
Okay, so more information on the UMOCA website?
Yes, at UtahMOCA, UtahMOCA.org.
Okay, Adam Price, Executive Director of UMOCA, thanks so much for your time and for explaining your new mission and your new name.
Thank you so much.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And of course, you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at City Views SLC. Next time, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson, and his guests include Representative Ken Sumption, who's running for Utah's governor's seat, and Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. So tune in tomorrow for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.